Welcome to this edition of Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your guest host for this episode, Dr. Doug Ray from Baltimore, Maryland. And today I'm speaking with Dr. Ed Kwan and Dr. Alan Workman. Dr. Kwan is the co-director of the UCI Comprehensive Skull-Base Program and Chief of Rhinology and Skull-Base Surgery at UC Irvine. And Dr. Workman is a fellowship-trained sinus and skull-base surgeon at the Mass Eye and Ear Infirmary in Boston, Massachusetts. And today we're going to be discussing their recent publication, the American Rhinologic Society Expert Practice Statement, Surveillance Strategies for Sinonasal Malignancy. Welcome to the podcast, gentlemen.
Thank you so much for having us, Doug.
Well, I appreciate you joining me. And I always try to pick articles that I think are going to really help the general ENT or people that are out there and working and need sort of guidance. And I think your paper provides a lot of us that aren't in an academic center and aren't seeing a lot of sinus malignancies with the important instructions and guidance as to how we can surveil these patients long-term. So I'm going to start with giving a little bit of an intro and then letting you guys and just asking you guys questions and letting you guys run with it. Does that sound okay?
Perfect.
Okay. So we know that sinonasal malignancy represents a small portion of head and neck malignancy, only about 5%, and that there's a pretty high rate of recurrence in these types of cancers ranging from 25 to 45%. And we also know there's a really large diversity in the subtypes and the locations and the behaviors of these tumors. They're very heterogeneous. And so there has been sort of a lack of recommendations, and these tumors are sort of the least studied of the head and neck tumors. And so there's been sort of a paucity of recommendations on surveillance for these. And so you guys had this great idea to form a sort of an expert practice statement written by a panel of 11 ARS fellowship-trained skull-base surgeons who are taking care of these patients on a regular basis. And you conducted a review of the papers that are out there, mainly systematic reviews and meta-analysis that covers these topics, and sort of synergized a list of recommendations. So my first question to you is, in thinking about your idea for this paper, tell me a little bit about what the clinical gap is that you recognized in terms of the recurring question in your practice that motivated you to develop this EPS specifically on surveillance.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Doug. Ed and I actually started talking about this back in 2018. And, you know, it's been kind of an evolution since then. There have been a couple papers where we were really looking at recurrence rates in sinonasal malignancy, how these tumors are recurring. Are they symptomatic recurrences? Are they asymptomatic recurrences? And we really were, you know, discovering some new, ideas about how we think about surveilling these tumors. And so, you know, the culmination of a couple of different papers, some multi-institutional studies that I can dig into a little bit, really all came together into saying, okay, we should summarize everything that we've discovered and other people have discovered in our rhinology field over the past 10 years and try to put that into context. Because sinonasal malignancy surveillance was really being borrowed from head and neck cancer overall. But as we know, you know, sinus tumors can behave differently. As you had stated, they're a much lower proportion of the head and neck tumors overall. And so just borrowing, you know, the national cancer guidelines doesn't necessarily make sense. And so that really motivated us to say, let's get all the data we have available, put that out there with some statements, and then kind of fill in the gaps and identify some other gaps that could, that might benefit from future work as well.
I also just want to add, Alan put it really nicely, but Alan has really driven a lot of this literature in the last couple of years. And it's a common interest of the both of us to just be able to take care of patients with these very challenging tumors, and just trying to understand from all the diverse histopathologies has become a very important issue to just understand how to follow them long-term in the best way. So that's what was part of the motivation as well.
So Alan, Ed, you sort of alluded on this in your opening remarks, but why is extrapolating from general head and neck cancer surveillance so problematic for trying to understand surveillance for sinonasal tumors?
Really, the key gap that we identified in, you know, in some of these early papers was that these sinonasal tumors were recurring in an asymptomatic fashion. And a lot of the existing head and neck cancer guidelines are predicated on the fact that a lot of patients who have recurrences in the oral cavity, recurrences in the oropharynx and the larynx are recurring in the presence of symptoms. And, you know, some papers say up to 80% of these patients are having symptom-driven recurrences that are then subsequently identified. But in the sinonasal tumor population, we were seeing rates closer to 50% where patients were having fully asymptomatic recurrences, you know, that meaning that they were caught by either imaging or endoscopy. And so we thought, you know, this really represents a group of patients that's particularly vulnerable to, you know, not being able to self-report their recurrences. And so, you know, figuring out what type of tailored surveillance protocols could be developed so that you catch them at a reasonable rate.
Yeah. Okay. So that makes great sense, Alan. Thank you. So real quick, I just want to ask a little bit about your methods. And for those listeners who don't really understand the Delphi method, you use the modified Delphi method, the process to reach consensus among the 11 fellowship trained rhinologists that reviewed the literature. Can you talk a little bit for the listeners just about that process and how that works?
Absolutely. So just like every other expert practice statement that the American Rhinologic Society has pushed forward, and we have a methodology that's been predefined for how to do this. For a topic like sinonasal malignancies and related research in these more niche areas, it's really been challenging to conduct high level of evidence studies given how rare the conditions are, the diverse histopathologies, and multidisciplinary treatment strategies, which may differ. So most of the literature stands on conclusions from retrospective studies or aggregate analyses, such as meta-analyses. And so randomized controlled trials, of course, would be the ideal for any subspecialty or any way to study any of these problems. But this isn't really feasible for many of the topics that we study in rhinology, especially for rare disease. And therefore, where there's limited evidence, expertise and experience become important. And thus, the modified Delphi consensus becomes a useful tool to provide guidance in these areas. So in each working group, we try to draw from experts with different training backgrounds and practice settings, and of course, practices in geographic locations all over, among many other factors that we consider in order to try to get a representative group of opinions.
Just to piggyback off that, it was actually, you know, fascinating working with this group. You know, the consensus among everyone about certain things, but also the diversity of practice, you know, especially even based on that geography, you know, when you think about surveillance paradigms and where patients live and everything like that. So, you know, as Ed mentioned, having a really diverse group so we could capture all of those opinions was very helpful to our process.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so for some of the otolaryngologists that are going to be using your guidelines, they're in rural areas and they're not at academic centers. So it's good to have that diversity in terms of your analysis and what you're looking at and your recommendations. One of the potential limitations of your paper, but you sort of alluded to this already, is that all of your evidence is grade C evidence. And that's basically because of the limitation in the level of studies that have been published. So tell us a little bit about how a clinician can interpret that practically and how strongly should this EPS influence our daily practice, given the fact that we're sort of relying on level C evidence.
Right. So the aggregate grade of evidence system for unfamiliar readers is something that the American Academy of Pediatrics first introduced. And we applied this level, this system across all of the ICARS and the EPSs. A grade C generally means that the evidence is based on observational studies, so case control of and cohort design, and may not be fully consistent with one another in terms of what they're putting forward. So again, this is this current state of the literature for sinonasal oncology in general, of, you know, very broadly covered even in ICS&T, where, you know, we looked at all of these different studies across different disciplines, but unfortunately, we just haven't had the ability to study it in a more rigorous fashion. So most of the studies in the EPS are based on single institutional retrospective studies. And though this may appear to mean that recommendations provided can be scientifically weak by interpretation, this is partially true, but through synthesis of the literature and expert opinions, the goal of an EPS is then that the recommendations with expert input provide a starting point for what high volume practices and dedicated experts with experience have found useful in their practices as to guide. Usually we say trainees, early career people, but it should also be able to be abstracted to more mature practices.
Okay, thanks, Ed. I mean, I think you'd agree with me that the bottom line is that we're using 11 experts to come up with guidelines using the best evidence that we can. And really, this is sort of the best synthesis that we can produce with what we have. You'd agree with that?
Absolutely.
Okay. So getting into the sort of meat of your paper, one of the strongest recommendations that you had was surveillance for at least 5 years, even in asymptomatic patients. So what data would you say most strongly convinced the group that this is necessary?
Absolutely. So as I alluded to earlier, the idea that you are having a lot of asymptomatic recurrences lends itself to the idea that we should be doing something routinely, right? Not just patient-driven follow-up. And so that was something that everyone agreed on. And then when you really look at the recurrence timing, you know, a lot of the means and medians across the cohorts that we were looking at spanned, you know, around 10 months to 3 years even. And that was the mean or the median. And late recurrences, you know, as we'll get into, I'm sure, you know, in some histologies really, really can drive those means and medians even later. And so, you know, contrary, again, not to harp on the head and neck squamous cell carcinoma of the oral cavity or oral pharynx, you're seeing much faster recurrences in those areas. And again, symptom-driven recurrences compared to what we have in the data on sinonasal malignancy specifically. So this really gives us at least a starting point for when you're working with a patient and they're finished their definitive treatment, surgery, any adjuvant treatment that they may have, where you can kind of at least give them a picture of what the next 5 years looks like. And that's something that I like to do.
Moving on into the sort of your next section, your next recommendation, which is talking about imaging strategy. Your group, the EPS, sort of emphasizes that MRI and the FDG PET are complementary rather than competing modalities in terms of assessing the potential for recurrence. In a real world practice, so I'm a private practice rhinologist, I'm not at a major academic center. How should I prioritize imaging when resources are limited and sort of decide which imaging I should use?
It's a really great question. And I think it's important to start by just framing exactly how we use each of these imaging modalities to provide information. So MRI and PET CT, both very helpful in providing snapshots of the patient's condition during surveillance. Of course, MRI gives a high resolution look at the local disease process, while PET provides insights on metastasis and picking up deep tissue or occult findings, which may also be asymptomatic. So of course, there's going to be challenges in consistently being able to obtain these studies, especially when we often face things like authorization issues for patients with lower means or patients who travel far to come in to see us, no matter what practice you're in. In those cases, the experts did also discuss this in the working group meeting, where we talk about alternatives such as using CT, which can certainly provide reasonable assessment of the local disease process and even restage patients pretty readily. I know certain countries are more prone to using that just based on availability and the speed of the exam. And then also considering reserving imaging for when new symptoms develop or if suspicious findings, which may not be symptomatic, are suspected. And these, of course, have to be weighted with the biological behavior of the tumor, where higher grade tumors may benefit from a lower threshold to image. These are considerations worth discussing with patients moving forward. And of course, we want to always tailor to their unique situations.
Just to piggyback off of Ed, this is a particular challenge when discussing these imaging modalities with patients and explaining why you're using each modality, how they're complementary in nature, and explaining the timing of each. You know, I certainly have some patients who are wondering why they're not getting more frequent PET CTs, for example. And that's, it's a combination of, not over imaging and, detecting potential false positives, but also, as you mentioned, the healthcare economics of it, I think, are very important and something that we considered for this EPS.
Yeah. And certainly you worry about with PET, because it's controversial, false positives, but you want to balance that with adequate surveillance and not missing a potential metastasis or occurrence. Moving into your next section, endoscopy is obviously something that we all use. Interestingly, in reading your paper, endoscopy detects sort of fewer total recurrences, but more surgically salvageable ones. So we can use endoscopy to find local recurrences that we can fix and operate on to help the patient. So how should that influence surveillance strategies in high-risk patients, in balancing all the types of modalities that we want to use? Explain to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the way I like to think about this is based on the literature that we have, endoscopy really seems to be the most likely modality that can find recurrence that we can do something about, you know, in a very short period of time, and is also helpful to detect in a short period of time. So we're thinking about superficial mucosal recurrences, you know, really early small nodules that might be missed on a CT or on an MRI, or even on a PET, you know, maybe reflected more as post-treatment change. And so your endoscopy is a tool in your hands where you are able to evaluate something over time. And it gives you, you know, a complementary modality that's extremely effective for these surface lesions. And so, you know, the way I think about this is we want to make sure that we have an endoscopy interval that makes sense for these patients in terms of actually capturing these recurrences in an efficient fashion. And so that really led it, you know, to some of the recommendations where we have, especially in that first year, 2 years, about the every 3 month endoscopy, where you can really pay close attention to the patient.
That makes perfect sense, Alan. And I will say for the listeners, we're not, because the data is so well synthesized and obvious, and when you read the paper, we're not going to delve down into the specific recommendations of, like, for instance, every 3 month endoscopy, but it's there. And so we're spending a little bit of time sort of understanding the nuances of this and why these recommendations exist based on the review of the literature and the expert opinion. So moving on, but sort of staying in the understanding of endoscopy, typically we see, when we're doing endoscopy, we can see normal appearing mucosa. And the recommendation of the paper, obviously, is that you're not biopsying on a regular basis normal appearing mucosa, which makes perfect sense, and most of us wouldn't. But there's a lot of clinicians out there who are surveilling these patients who aren't in an academic center, and they're worried about these patients, and they see what they appear to be is normal mucosa on their endoscopic exam. They're surveilling them, say, for the first few years, every 3 months. And then, so give us some guidance, Alan and Ed, in terms of what clinical or imaging red flags would promote sort of a biopsy in what may be an equivocal or normal appearing exam.
It's a really great point that you bring up, Doug. And I think all of us have been asked to biopsy normal mucosa just based on concern for a neoplastic, inflammatory, or rheumatologic condition. And I think most of us would absolutely agree that the overall yield is very low in those cases, just because we're very much trained to be able to discern what is normal versus abnormal. So some factors in consideration that can drive biopsy would be exam or endoscopic change in an area that otherwise has remained stable on documentation in the past, or new symptoms, especially if correlating to a change in imaging, or even as we discussed earlier about PET, if it newly lights up in a suspicious location, such as near the primary site or within the primary field itself, those are things that would potentially push the surgeon to consider biopsy. It's also possible to have highly concerning false positives on imaging that drive biopsy, such as, for example, pseudoprogression in patients treated with immunotherapy, or tumors which are actively involuting and undergoing necrosis after chemotherapy. So those can take some time to really try to discern out, but those are the scenarios that I would think would usually drive biopsy on endoscopy.
That's super helpful in guiding our decisions. And again, to reiterate to the audience, the specific recommendations in terms of imaging, which Ed alludes to, are in the paper. So just sort of to wrap it up towards the end of our discussion, looking ahead, in your expert opinion, what developments in terms of better imaging, biomarkers like ctDNA or data that's being collected in large multi-institutional data sets, what do you two see as sort of the biggest developments and things that we need to pay attention to when we review the literature and when we're listening to the experts? What are the big changes on the horizon in terms of what will change our surveillance practice in the next few years?
I think the future is going to likely follow the current trends of precision medicine, and where surveillance strategies are going to be more tailored to specific histopathologies, especially as we understand the tumor biology more. So good examples right now that are becoming more mainstream are using DOTATATE as a PET tracer for neuroendocrine tumors, or using circulating tumor DNA to monitor HPV positive sinonasal tumors. There's also opportunity for better multi-center clinical research, understanding critical time points for highest likelihood of recurrence or metastasis, or determining thresholds beyond which recurrence and metastasis are highly unlikely. There's some studies out there on other types of tumors like that. And of course, I think we would all agree that I'd be amiss if I didn't mention that AI would likely play a large part in this over time, where there's probably going to be some integration of radiomics, endoscopy images, and then symptoms can all predict the likelihoods of events that can happen.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything that Ed said. And I do think that what will be most useful to us is gathering data from many, many institutions, especially for these rare tumor subtypes. You know, when you have a patient who sits in front of you with a SMARCB1 deficient carcinoma, they ask questions, you know, about what's the, you know, survival rate, what's the recurrence rate? And these are questions that are really challenging to answer in these rare tumor subtypes. And so understanding a little bit better about what they look like over time by harnessing all of the cases available to us is really going to help drive future recommendations for surveillance and then also for, you know, patient guidance that we can give.
So to wrap up our chat tonight, sort of wrap it up with a bow, I want to ask each of you this last question. If there's one surveillance practice that you hope clinicians change immediately after reading your paper, this EPS, what would it be?
You know, I think one of the biggest practices that can help clinicians really understand the tools that they have at their disposal and that they should be surveilling these patients with endoscopy at a reasonable rate, especially, you know, in particularly risky tumor subtypes, even for a prolonged period of time in some of those subtypes. And so, you know, it's a conversation that you have to have with the patients, synthesizing everything that we have here. But I think that if you present them this data, patients will understand why you're surveilling them the way that you are. And that really lends credence to your recommendations. And so a patient doesn't necessarily have to be nervous if you're getting, you know, a PET CT at a specific time point, if you know that that's what's best based on the data that we have. And so I think just making data-driven decisions based on the paucity of data we have available is probably the best thing that you can do in your practice right now as we continue to generate new data.
I love what Alan just said. And again, it's a discussion with the patient, but also focusing on one of the major tenets of cytonasal oncology, which is histopathology is king. And just like we treat patients using histopathology-based methodology, surveillance should also be tailored to histopathology. And we should all remember that it's not just 5 years and free like mucosal head and neck cancer in the traditional literature.
Thank you both for joining me. And I think for the listeners, this is a excellently written paper with very clear guidelines that I think if you're in practice and you're seeing these patients, even if they've been treated elsewhere and they're coming back to you, let's say you sent them to an academic center and then they come back to you and you're surveilling them, I think this paper will provide you sort of with an excellent roadmap for when you're going to order imaging, when you're going to perform endoscopy, and it's variable based on the tumor and the location. So I really appreciate you two joining us tonight. And I think that your paper is going to be very helpful for all of us, both in academic practice, but more specifically for those of us who are in a general private practice to take excellent care of these patients. So thanks so much, guys, for taking a little bit of time out on a Wednesday night and joining me.
Thank you so much for having us, Doug.
Thank you so much, Doug. This was a pleasure.
I'd be remiss to point out that this is Alan's second Scope It Out in 2 months. So I think that might be a record. So congratulations, Alan.
We wouldn't have it any other way.
Exactly. Keep doing the great work, Alan. And
thank you very much, Doug. Thank you very much, Ed.
So I just want to thank our Scope It Out listeners for joining us tonight. This is Doug Ray for Scope It Out, the official podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. And take care. Thank you.